the Sedra begins with Shoftim v'Shotrim, which seems to deal with the judges and policemen, and not too much to do with us personally. However, many of the Mepharshim say that the fact that it says Titein Lecha, right, judges and officers, you should give to yourself, right, even though that's not the simple meaning, implies that you have to be a judge and a policeman over yourself too. And the function of a judge is to come up with what is just and proper, and the shoter is to enforce it. And every person needs to be a judge in their own lives, and know how to judge, or at least to ask advice, to be able to judge properly what is their proper behavior, proper conduct in any specific situation, and then to implement within their own lives the ways of implementing those judgments. People can have tremendous good intentions and know what's right, but not have the fortitude to carry it through. So just like there are judges, and then there are officers who force the people to carry through what the judgment was, a person has to do that also. And some of the Mepharshim say that it's more specific. It's not just to be a judge for yourself and to be an officer over yourself, but b'chol sha'arecha. B'chol sha'arecha means all the openings to your body, your eyes, your ears, so on, mouth, what you permit into your body, what you permit to leave your body, what words, what you permit to be, to hear, to see, all of that needs tremendous judgment and tremendous discipline to implement the judgment properly. Okay, so therefore the Sedra is very relevant, especially to the month of Elul. We're preparing for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we're going to be judged. You want to be judged properly, you have to judge yourself properly also. Okay. Next. Torah says, Osita lecha asherah kol eitz eis o mizbach Hashem elokecha. There was a prohibition of planting trees near the Mizbeach. One of the ideas behind that is the following. A tree represents something that brings forth fruit. And the Mizbeach, one could think that you're feeding God, kibiyochel, right? Making a sacrifice, and it even sounds like that, called Bani Lachmi Le'ishai. This is my bread. But obviously God doesn't eat, and he doesn't need your sacrifices or whatever. So, because if that would be the case, he's been starving for a long time. So, obviously that's not the case at all. The idea of sacrifices is korban is to bring you closer to God. So the purpose of the sacrifice is not for God's sake, it's for your sake. But if you have a tree growing by the altar, when you came there, you would have this idea of creating a situation of fruit, of sustenance. So in order to totally distance that from the idea of the altar, can't plant any trees near the altar, not to get this idea of that you're satiating, you're creating and providing sustenance to God. So then one would say, if that's the case, if God really gets nothing out of this, what difference would I bring? So why should I bring the best? Right, bring the worst. God doesn't care if it's a good animal, a bad animal. Why should I waste the money? Right after that, the Torah says, "Losizbach Hashem Elokecha Shor Baser Sheyeh Bamu." Don't sacrifice an animal that has a blemish, because true, it's not for God's sake. God couldn't care less if the animal's blemished, not blemished, for His sake. But since the whole idea of the sacrifice is the impression it makes on you, and therefore it should be something that is worthy, and not, you know, the seconds or whatever. And there's another Sfarno in Harshis Emor that says the concept of not bringing a Balmum is not because the animal is inferior, because there are certain blemishes that are induced in the animal on purpose. to make the animal fatter, bigger, whatever, to castrate animals in order to oxen, to make them stronger, bigger, whatever. So fatter. So could be that the blemish even causes the animal to be superior. But the idea of not bringing a blemished animal is, it's not complete. When it comes to serving the Rabbanu Shel Olam, the main thing is not quantity, but quality. So you can have a big fat animal, but if it's not complete, if it's blemished, then that's not the way to serve the Rabbanu Shel Olam. So it's not so much for God's sake that he needs a nice fat animal, and he wouldn't be happy with an inferior animal. It just doesn't make the same impression on you. You bring something nice, then you're offering something to the Rabbanu Shel Olam that you know is complete. It gives you the incentive to want to serve the Rabbanu Shel Olam in a complete way. Therefore, a Baal Mum, you don't bring. The biggest proof for that is that in Avodas Hashem, it's quality and not quantity. It's how perfect the thing is, not how big it is. That if you have one of these gigantic challahs they have in the chasana, you know, 3-4 feet long, and somebody cut off the end, and you have a little roll, a dinner roll, and you're going to eat both of them, and you have to know which one to make the motzi on. So the halacha is you make the motzi on the dinner roll, not on the gigantic challah, because the dinner roll is complete, and the big challah is not complete. Okay. Torah then says the halacha about pishnayim edim yochum dover. You need two witnesses to give a person a punishment, whether it's lashes or a death penalty or any other penalty. You need two witnesses to create marriage, divorce, anything that has to do with arayas, or to what's it called, to create a situation where a woman becomes prohibited to her husband because she's a sulta. In all those situations, you need two qualified kosher witnesses, which in 1 second we will discuss what that is. Monetary cases also. In order to transfer money from one person to another, right, in a court case, you need witnesses in order to do that. One witness is not enough. Two kosher witnesses have to be. For other things that have to do with, hold up. First let me give you the problem. What are two kosher witnesses? First, they have to be Jewish. Can't be slaves, even Jewish, well, not even non-Jewish slaves who are partially Jewish. Because a non-Jewish slave is somewhere in between, you know, twilight zone between being Jewish and not Jewish. He's not kosher to be an aid. Can't be under bar mitzvah. And can't be a woman. Now, on the surface, that should bother at least some of the people in the room. Meaning the following. Let me make it bother you even more. Two 16-year-old, okay, boys over bar mitzvah who are already shaving, so they're really bar mitzvah, okay, come to court, and they say that we saw Reuven kill Shimon at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning in Chashmonai. And we investigate, and we interrogate them, and we cross-examine them, and their testimony holds up under all that interrogation. We take out Reuven and we execute based on the testimony of these two 16-year-old boys. If two very chashuva rebbetzins who were in their 80s, okay, let's make them the 70s because maybe senile, they're 80s, but they're in their 70s, okay? And they come to court and they say, we saw Reuven kill Shimon 10 o'clock on Sunday in Chashmonai. We tell them, ladies, we appreciate your efforts, but you are not kosher witnesses, and we can't do anything according to your testimony, so go home, go bake a chocolate cake, and we can't be involved in your testimony. Okay, shouldn't bother you. Two 16-year-old boys, we believe, enough to execute Reuven. Two very chashuva rebbetzins, we send home. The truth is, it has nothing to do with the Torah trusts or doesn't trust women, believes them, doesn't believe them, because the fact that the Torah said, that you believe two witnesses is not because we know for sure that two witnesses are telling the truth, because it may be they're not telling the truth. We don't know for sure. Except the Torah said that if they pass all of the interrogation and investigation that the Torah gives out, how to interrogate witnesses and cross-examine them or whatever, then you have to follow as if they're telling the truth. We don't know for sure. But that's the law the Torah gives. And therefore, the fact that we believe two witnesses is not because we know for sure they're telling the truth. It's because the Torah gave them power that if they say something and it holds up, according to the laws of interrogating witnesses the Torah gives, then you have to function as if they're telling the truth. So the Torah gives the power to those two witnesses. It's not because we believe them. I'll tell you 1 second the difference. The difference is the following. What would you say in the following case, logically? Two witnesses come. We know that Shimon is dead. Okay? We have the body. Okay? We know that he was shot through the head. Okay? In a way that he couldn't have done it himself. So we know pretty much that Shimon was murdered by somebody. We have no idea who. Two witnesses come and they say, we saw Reuven shoot Shimon through the head. 10 o'clock in the morning in Kashmonai. And then 1,000 other witnesses come and they say, what are you talking about? There was a big Hafganah in Chashmonoyim on that day, right? And we were there too. And we saw Levi shoot Shimon through the head on that day. A whole 1,000 of them said, we were all standing around. What are you talking about, Reuven? It was Levi that killed. So 1,000 people telling you that Levi shot Shimon, and 2 people telling you that Reuven shot Shimon. What would you say you should do logically? Accept the 1,000 and tell the 2 to go home. Right? Obviously you made a mistake and 1,000 people disagree with you. That's not the halacha. The halacha is we tell them both, I'm sorry, but we don't know who to follow. Right? 2 are equal to 1,000 and they cancel each other out. And we don't kill anybody. We don't kill Reuven. We don't kill Levi. Shimon remains dead. And that is stalemate. That's all. You can't do anything. What? Because both of them, because both of them could not have killed Shimon, right? And in addition, right, yeah, both of them couldn't have killed Shimon. Besides that, there's contradictory witnesses. I mean, according to these second ones, the first one's a liar. She can't kill Reuven. According to the first ones, the second one's a liar. She can't kill Shimon. She can't kill Levi. Now, does that make any sense logically? No. But the Rambam says, what is it based on? The fact that the reason we believe the 2 is not because they believe, and the Mele we believe 1,000 more, it's because the Torah gave the power that 2 witnesses, and more than 2 witnesses, have the power to make you function as a court and follow their directive, their testimony, as if it was true. So the same power the Torah gave to 2 is the same power to 1,000. There's no difference. So they cancel each other out. Another show that has nothing to do with believability. If it had to do with credibility, for sure 1,000 people are more credible than 2. It has nothing to do with that. It's a din ha-Torah that is beyond rationale. It's not based on rationale. Another proof. 2 16-year-old boys come. They tell me that Reuven killed Shimon. We kill Reuven. Moshe and Aaron HaKohen come to court. And they say, we saw Reuven kill Shimon. We tell them, I'm sorry, but you're brothers. Brothers can't testify together. But I'm Moshe Rabbeinu. This is Aaron. You think we're lying? No, we don't think you're lying. I think you're telling the truth. But the Torah said, we can't accept your testimony. You're not kosher witnesses together because brothers can't be kosher witnesses together or other relatives. So we throw them out of court and we don't do anything to Reuven. Do we believe 2 16-year-olds more than Moshe and Aaron? We think they're lying? No. But the Torah only gave power in certain situations, and this is not the case where those witnesses have a power. They're basically one witness. They're not 2 witnesses. So the same Torah that said that 1,002 are equal, the same Torah that said that you can't accept Moshe and Aaron together as witnesses, the same Torah said you can't accept women. Does that impugn the credibility of women? No. It doesn't impugn the credibility of Moshe and Aaron either. It's just that is the rule of the Torah. Is it rational? Not necessarily. Does it impugn, again, the credibility of women? No. Just as much as it doesn't impugn the credibility of 1,000 people over two or Moshe and Aaron together. Why is it like that? I don't know. Torah doesn't say the reason. I don't know why Moshe and Aaron can't testify. I don't know why 1,000 are not better than two. But that's the law of the Torah. Therefore, I don't know why women not. But whatever the reason is, women not. But that's where you need testimony. That's only, like I said, to punish people. Capital punishment or lashes or something like that. Or to take money away from somebody. Right? You need testimony most of the time. Right? There are other possibilities too, but witnesses, one witness won't help. One witness can only make the other person swear under certain circumstances to go against the witness, but he can't take the money away from the person. And to establish marriage, divorce, and things like that. However, anything that's not in those categories, for instance, I have a piece of meat, I don't know if it's kosher or not, and one witness comes along and says, I know for sure that meat's kosher. You're allowed to eat it. That's called the Eidech of Neman Bisu. Okay? Barring any, details, right? One witness, whether it's a man, a woman, here again, you still need to be over by mitzvah, because a child may not know what he's talking about, right? But if you're an adult, male, female, doesn't make a difference. Eidech of Neman Bisu. One witness is believed. In fact, where do we learn that one witness is believed in these kind of situations where all you need is credibility? From women. One of the places we learn it from is from the fact that the Torah believed a woman to make all of the calculations when it comes to Taras HaMishpacha, which is a very private thing. You obviously don't need two witnesses to testify, right, whether she's Tahor or not. It's a private thing, and that the Torah believed her. So, So you see that we believe a person, credibility-wise, when it doesn't involve the things that I mentioned before, one witness is believed, and a woman is believed just as much as a man. Okay. And therefore, right, if I go home for lunch, right, and I tell my wife, where's the mashgiach? Right, how do I know that lunch is kosher? She said, I made it, I know it's kosher. I know, but you're a woman, you know, I can't need two witnesses. That's ridiculous. You don't need two witnesses. You believe her, believe him, whatever it is, that it's kosher. That's Eidech of Neman Bisur. So it has nothing to do with credibility. Credibility of a woman is believed just as much as a man. Since we're talking about witnesses, let's go to a case that's in the end of the parsha. Edim Zomim. So like I told you, if two witnesses come and say Reuven killed Shimon, two witnesses come and say no, Levi killed Shimon, right, we throw them both out of court. Cancel them out, we don't do anything. What happens in the following case? Two witnesses come, and they say Reuven killed Shimon at 10 o'clock in front of the Weinsteins in Kashmonayim on Sunday. Okay. Two other witnesses come, and they say we don't know if Reuven killed Shimon or not in front of the Weinsteins' house on Sunday in Kashmonayim. Because we weren't there. But we were in America, in Disneyland. And you two witnesses who say that you were in front of the Weinstein house on 10 o'clock Sunday and saw this murder were with us in Disneyland. There's no way in the world that you could have seen this. So you're for sure lying. Then the Torah says the following. We believe the second witnesses, and whatever the first witnesses wanted to do to the person they testified against, we do to them. So we kill them. The question is, why in this case do you believe the second ones and not just cancel them out? Here also. I'm saying I was there. You're saying I wasn't there. So let's cancel out. I say Reuven killed. You say Levi killed. We cancel out. But if I say Reuven killed and you say I wasn't there, then we believe the second pair. What's the difference? So one idea is, the most predominant idea is the following. Where two witnesses come and they say Reuven killed Shimon, and two other witnesses come and say Levi killed Shimon, so they're both testifying about the case, and they cancel each other out. We don't know who to believe. But when two witnesses come and say Reuven killed Shimon, they're testifying about the case. The next two witnesses aren't testifying about the case at all. We don't know what happened. We don't know if Reuven killed Shimon or not. Maybe he did. But we know you didn't see it because you were with us. They're not testifying about the case. They're testifying about the witnesses. And the witnesses aren't believed about themselves. You can only testify about somebody else. You can't testify about yourself. So therefore, because you're related to yourself, relatives can't testify. So the Edim, right, are not testifying on the case, and therefore there is a contradiction between this testimony and this testimony. We're saying we don't know what happened with the case. We're not arguing that Reuven killed Shimon. What we're saying is you couldn't have seen it because you weren't there. So we're testifying about you. You can't testify about yourself. So we have testimony about you that is not contradicted. So you become Edom's own. So we believe the second pair. We don't kill Reuven, right? But we do kill the witnesses.
What happened if another person come and say, oh, he was actually there and sure happened to him?
So if they say he was actually there, what's it called, then they're testifying about the case also. They have, if another set of witnesses comes and says, how could you say that you saw so-and-so in Disney World on that day when you were with us in Australia? Then the first one is exonerated and we kill Reuven and the second pair get killed. We do to them what they wanted to do to the first pair. And this could go on forever, right? Two more people come and say, no, you were with us. And what's it called? So there's only one stipulation here, which also is not on the surface rational, beyond rationale, but there's an idea behind it also, and that's the problem. Two witnesses come and they say Reuven killed Shimon. Okay, and the court accepts their testimony and decrees a death sentence on Reuven. And then two witnesses come and say, wait, hold off everything. Don't execute Reuven. There's a terrible miscarriage of justice here. These two people are liars. They were with us. Then we kill the two witnesses. What happens, though? Two witnesses come and they say Reuven killed Shimon. The Beis Din accepts their testimony, gives Reuven a death sentence, and carries it out. Now Reuven's dead already. Then two witnesses come and say you did a terrible thing because you killed an innocent man. Because these people weren't there. They're liars. They're with us in Disney World. Then we don't kill the witnesses. We only kill them if their testimony didn't result in the execution of the person they testified against. But if they already, came and the guy was executed, we don't kill them. So it makes sense, right? If they didn't kill anybody, we kill them. If they end up killing somebody. So let me tell you some ideas why that's the case. The case is because the Torah said, "Kashizom and Lazos Leokid," as they plan to do, not as was done. What's the idea behind this? A few ideas. One idea is the first, the problem. Killing somebody in an earthly death sentence is an atonement for the person. But if the person's sin was so great that the atonement can't happen, so we don't kill them in this world, God will take care of them in the next world. Proof to that is the following. It says that if a person has 10 children and he burns 9 of them to Moloch, but he leaves one, he gets a death penalty. He burns some of his children. But if he burns all 10, he doesn't get a death penalty. So one of the ways to explain, there's other ways of explaining why that's the case. One of the ways of explaining is, if you do some of your children, you could still get some kind of atonement by being executed. But if you do all your children, this sin is so serious, there's no atonement in this world. So why kill the guy? God will take care of him later. We don't have to kill him and atone. God didn't give us the ability to atone for him. It's not we want to get even with him or whatever, we want to atone. There's no atonement. There's another reason, too. The other reason is that they used to sacrifice their children in order that the ones that remain would be successful. But if you do all your children, there's nobody remaining, that's not Moloch. That's some crazy thing you did. That's not the idolatry of Moloch. But this is one reason. There's no kapar. Same thing over here. If I just wanted to have somebody killed, but he wasn't actually executed, there's still a chance to give atonement to these witnesses by killing them. But if they already ended up having this guy killed, then the sin is so great, there's no atonement. So why kill them? But God will take care of them in the next world. There's only one problem with that. Why should that be worse than if they killed the guy with their own hands. If you murder somebody, there's atonement, and you get a death penalty. If you just cause the court to kill somebody, there is no atonement. The answer is very simple. If I go and kill somebody, so I killed somebody, I can have atonement for my sin. But if I cause a Jewish court to kill somebody wrongly, I cause these 23 tzaddikim to go and murder somebody basically now, because he didn't deserve to be killed, that sin is much greater than me killing somebody. Right? Here it's more, you know, planned out, and I involve other people in carrying this out. That's a much greater sin. So that is that's an idea behind this idea that only if he's not executed do we execute them. If he's executed already, then we don't. Okay. Melech, next parasha is the parasha of Melech. You come and you want a king. So it says there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, which raises a very big problem with what happened in the time of Shmuel, where they came and asked for a king, and God was angry with them, and Shmuel was angry with them. The Torah says, if you ask for a king, it's a mitzvah to have a king. So some say that they prematurely did it. You only need a king when you don't have a qualified leader. Shmuel was a qualified leader. There wasn't a time yet for a king. They prematurely asked for the king. It's one answer. Another answer is the way they asked for the king was wrong. You should want a king to help you follow the Torah, not because you want to be like Goyim or the king. When they came, their main idea was they wanted a king to be like all the other nations of the world. Not that the king should be specifically the Jewish kind of king who stands in God's place or whatever. We want to be like the nations of the world. That was the problem. A third answer is that the way they expressed it, they said, Tnu lanu melech, give us the king. We'll tell the king what to do. In other words, he's going to be our man. Right? So, that's not. A king is som tasim alecha melech. You accept the authority of the king. Don't think you're going to tell the king what to do. It says that before Mashiach comes, the leaders of the generation, secular leaders, are going to be like dogs. So you could understand that literally. But there's a deeper way of understanding it. And that's the following. Rav Yisrael Salanter says, if you came from Mars, you never saw a human being, and you see this four-legged creature leading a two-legged creature on a leash. The dog is walking in front, the guy's walking behind, so you'd say, oh, the earth is inhabited by these little four-legged creatures that lead around two-legged creatures. When they come to a corner, the dog looks back to see where the guy wants to go. Then you realize, hey, it's not the dog that's leading the man, it's the man that's leading the dog from behind. He just looks like he's being led, except he's really the one who's leading. So that's the way the leader's going to be. They're going to walk in the front, and you're going to think they're the leaders. But every time they want to make a decision, they look back to see where the people want to go. They don't want to do what's right. They want to do what's popular, because they want to retain their seats. So therefore, the leaders are going to be like dogs, right? Dogs look like they're leading, but they're really being led. And the leaders will look like they're leading, but they're really being led. It's a very, very nice idea. So therefore, when they asked for a king, they said, you give us the king, right? He's our man. We'll make sure that he says what we want him to say. That kind of king is possible. You want to accept the authority of a king, that's fine. There's a big machlokas between the Rishonim. If when the Torah says, if you want a king, appoint a king, is that the ideal? There should be a king. Or no, that's if you want a king. So, but the Abarbanel says, and the Abarbanel was the treasurer of King Ferdinand. So he had his fill of kings and queens. So you can understand where he's coming from. He says that monarchy is not the ideal. Okay? Until Mashiach comes, right, and there'll be a monarch like that, or a monarch like David, maybe that's ideal. But until then, the kings, even the Jewish kings, weren't all that great. So he says what's better is a democracy, where the people elect their officials. and people don't lead by divine rule or by monarchy, but by democracy, says Rabbi Benel. Most of the Rishonim argue with him, and the Torah said that there's a monarchy, right? And Lamaisa, I guess the Rabbi Benel saw the evils of a monarchy, but he never really saw what a democracy is. Had he lived today and saw what it is, he would realize that democracy is not too much better than any kind of monarchy, right? So I don't know what is, okay, what kind of government would, Mashiach will come, that will be the kind of government that will be okay. Until then, it's not too much, okay, so in any case, so that is, the purpose of a melech, I always like to say, is three purposes. And because there's three purposes, the Torah gave three special prohibitions to a king. One purpose of a king is to be the unifying factor of the Jewish people. He unifies the people. He gives them one common person to unify. He creates the Malchus. He creates a kingdom. And everybody then becomes servants and citizens in that kingdom, working for one common goal. So the king is a unifier. God also unifies us. That's also one function of God's being a king. We coronate God as a king on Rosh Hashanah to give us unity of purpose. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Malchus. In order to achieve that, the king can't be separate from the people. He has to be amongst the people, because otherwise he can't unify them. So therefore the king can't lo yorum levavo. He shouldn't get a lot of money and amass a tremendous amount of wealth and be totally separated from the people. It says by shol hamela, from his shoulders, he was head and shoulders above the people. So that doesn't describe him physically, because he'd better be like a giraffe, right? If he was equal to the people till his head and shoulders, and after that, he had a big neck. Now the idea is, there's two ways of being above people. One is, their head starts where your heels end, so you're above them. The other way is that you're amongst them, but you tower above them. That's the second way is how Shaul was. He wasn't separated from the people. He wasn't up there somewhere. He was down to earth together with them. But still he towered above them. That's how a king has to be. Otherwise he can't be a unifying factor, because he's totally separated, right, and distant from the people. Second purpose of a king is to be an advisor. He creates the kingdom and he advises people how to fit into that kingdom. The word melech comes from the word lehimalech. To ask advice, to give advice. So the king is an advisor. Okay, that's the purpose of a king also. And in order to be an advisor, his heart has to be in the right place. He has to be able to be focused. So he can't have too many wives. In order that his heart is not, pushed in many different ways by other people. He has to be able to be focused to give people advice. So he can't have a lot of wives. And lastly, he defends the people. He defends his malchus. That's the third function of a king, a defender. He's a unifier, a advisor, and a defender. He defends the malchus, creates the malchus, he supports the malchus with advice and with sustenance or whatever. He makes sure that his kingdom is taken care of, physically, materially, and spiritually. And he defends it from threats from the outside. In order to do that, he can't compromise the defense of his country by going back to Egypt to get horses and making alliances with Egypt or whatever. So he can't have too many horses, shouldn't go back to Egypt. He's not going to defend the people in that way. So therefore the three special mitzvahs of the Kohen: shouldn't have too much money, shouldn't have too many wives. By the way, too many wives need more than 18. Up until 18 is not too many. Some people think one is too many, but in any case, that's more than 18 for sure. So and he can't have too many horses, because he may go back to Egypt, which supplied horses. Those three things contradict the three functions of the king: the unifier, sustainer, which means giving also advice or whatever, and the protector. Those three are there, come in conflict with those three functions. And the Rabban Shalom also functions those three ways. He gives us unity, he defends us, and he advises us through the Torah, through Chachamim, whatever. He gives us constant advice, and he sustains us. So the Rabban Shalom functions as a king the same way that an earthly king, and therefore an earthly king is a symbol. Now, Chusadara came up with the Rakia. If you want to know what the heavenly kingdom is like, you can learn it from the earthly kingdom. So that's why one of the purposes of an earthly king, you have somebody to focus on, who then you can transfer that to understand there's a greater king. That's why it says that Shlomo HaMelech sat on God's throne, meaning he was a God's representative. The earthly king that represented the fact that there's a heavenly king. Okay. The heavenly king. Okay. The heavenly king. Okay.